Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Well, greetings everyone from Florida's Space Coast. On a picture-perfect, sunny and 74 degrees Chamber of Commerce day here in Brevard County. I am Jim Behnke, and this is the January 23rd, 2010 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, this is going to be a fast hour of discussion about the space program, so buckle up as we look back to the very beginning of the space age with the with a very special guest. Frederick Ordway III will join us in the second segment. At any time along the way today, if you have a question or comment about anything having to do with our space program, you can feel free to call in. Join us in the discussion on the program. You can call locally here, 768-1240. AT&T wireless customers along Florida's Space Coast can dial up star 1240, and they'll be able to reach us with a free phone call. If you happen to be listening to our live stream online at WMMBAM.com, welcome. You can call us from anywhere in the world at 321-768-1240 or send us email to spacetalking@AOL.com. Well, a blizzard of reports on this warming trend here in Florida anyway, a blizzard of reports surfaced this past week or so related to our space program, and I don't think any of them really offered any positive news or perspective on the future of our space program. I have to admit that when I was looking through them, an old bit from that old TV show, Hee Haw, you remember that show? Go ahead, raise your hand, admit it, you used to watch it. You know, the one where the skit where they do every once in a while where the four guys are laying on the floor and, you know, they're all depressed and they got their hats low and they're just laying there and they're bored and they start singing this song, you know, gloom, despair, and agony on me. Well, that was kind of the sense I had reading some of these reports. Let's start out, a week ago, I guess it was a week ago yesterday, a week ago Friday, that the Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel came out with their annual report, and we touched on it very briefly last week. But basically it said that we need to get off the shuttle, go ahead and retire that vehicle, but if for some reason the plans say that we need to keep flying that vehicle for any reason in any way, be ready to pay a lot of money that basically NASA doesn't have because there's some they want to recertify. I mean, we need to recertify that vehicle and go back and really look for those little things that that are sitting out there that if we kept flying this vehicle for another couple of years, we want to make sure we understand. And that would be a tough proposition. The panel did say that the Ares 1 rocket, we saw the 1X test rocket earlier last year, the Ares 1 rocket is still the best choice, they believe, for NASA's next launch vehicle for astronauts. And controversially, they said, in part because they don't think that the commercial folks know what they're doing yet in terms of flying astronauts on these new rockets. And that's an opinion, by the way, I don't necessarily share. And I know that Elon Musk and the team at SpaceX that are very far along in getting their Falcon 9 ready to go, looks like sometime hopefully in March, and with their spacecraft called the Dragon, are on top of it and know what they're doing. And, you know, proof will be in the pudding. We'll see them fly. We talked about it before. But, I think the commercial folks just might be the people on the white horse, the knight on the white horse that saves some of this. Anyway, there are a lot of other things in the report, interesting, boring, interesting, boring, back and forth. One thing that was interesting, they mentioned that NASA hadn't been very responsive to their recommendations from last year. I thought that was interesting. The other interesting comment they made that really caught my eye was one about concern about NASA personnel flying Russian aircraft from Moscow to Baikonur for launches and for launches and recoveries and whatnot, that they didn't want to have all of the senior NASA people on one Russian airplane that NASA had no insight into as terms of the safety of that particular aircraft. And I thought that was an interesting comment as well. On Wednesday, the latest forecast for what will happen to space shuttle-related jobs came out from the Brevard Workforce. And according to their analysis, the best numbers now stands between 6,400 and 7,000 jobs lost here on the Space Coast when it's all said and done. Other jobs will be introduced. People will transition. But in terms of the number of jobs lost, that was the number. Actually, in reading some of the details and the way they approached it, I kind of thought that it was one of the most honest appraisals I've seen really since 2004 when it was first announced that the shuttle retirement was going to happen. And I think this report really does kind of slice and dice the numbers in a very logical and objective way. They had some really good data that they worked with. I know that they wanted some more data, but it was needed to be protected for privacy reasons. But I think folks should pay attention to these fine details. And I think maybe it's probably time to spend another whole hour on Space Talk on this subject about our workforce. So I think maybe we can try to put something together here in the coming weeks. A lot of good stuff in that workforce document, by the way, about initiatives that we need to take in terms of the state of Florida and the next session. And I know Frank DiBello from Space Florida was up in Tallahassee last week and really laid it out, I think, in an outstanding fashion, what we need and the money we need and the priorities that we have and how we need to rejuggle the priorities based on past experience as to what we need to really grow economic development in space. And again, that's something we will definitely be talking about as the March session kicks off here pretty soon. Let's see. I wanted to mention real quick that, by the way, if you happen to be lost about what's going on with NASA right now, there's so much going on, good and bad, options and future and past and present. You know, if you really want to know what's going on right now and you really want a concise summary of what the planning is right now, what officially is going on, what officially options are being discussed, the Congressional Research Service put out their latest summary of all things NASA this past week. Now, the Congressional Research Service is a service for Congress. It's Congress's own research arm. And I got to tell you, through the years covering this program the way I have, you know, their reports about space are keepers. I mean, they're great for historical documents, and they're great for reference documents. They produce the most objective, straightforward explanations of what folks need to know. I know Marcia Smith wrote many of those reports for many years before she moved on. I don't happen to know the author of this current document, but the reports are great, and they're written at a level. You know, let's be careful here. They're written at a level that I think most of our representatives can actually understand. No, I won't guess as to what grade level that might be, but it is as in terms of NASA being a technical agency, it really is well written. All of these documents are out there. I think what I'll do to be convenient is I'll put them all on our WMMBAM.com website, the Space Talk website. Go to WMMBAM.com and use keyword Space Talk, and tonight I'll put these documents up. You can download them and read them yourself and hang on to them. Finally, speaking of gloom and despair and agony, the National Academy of Sciences put out a report this week that said, among everything else NASA is not getting enough money to do, the space agency is woefully underfunded for its mission to find asteroids that could potentially strike the Earth and wreck everyone's day, as in permanently. 85% of asteroids a half mile wide or larger have been found, but only 15% of asteroids in the 460-foot range have been found, and only 5% of rocks about 164 feet wide have been found. And it only takes an asteroid a mile wide to wipe out the planet Earth in terms of all life. So we need more money for that, too. Well, look, when we return, we'll be joined by someone who was there at the beginning of the space age and has spent most of his life telling the story to other people. Frederick Ordway will be with us in just a minute or two right here on Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Lines. I'm Jim Banky. Welcome aboard, and you're listening to WMMB.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to join me today with your questions or comments. I want to take just a few seconds again to remind everyone listening now or on the recorded podcast that the need in Haiti continues. Donations of all types, especially money, is still needed. So if you haven't done so yet, please give something back. Not because it's fashionable or because you might get a tax deduction, but do it because it's the right thing to do. If you need help finding a place to donate or to help out, visit WMMBAM.com on the main homepage there, and you'll find a link for helpful resources to give back and help out Haiti. Okay, well, let's see. Once again, we start the story. Growing up in Minnesota, you know, I had many influences that steered me toward a career with the space program. You know, on TV, it was the Apollo missions and Star Trek and even the occasional episode of Gilligan's Island. You know, my favorite movies as a kid were The Reluctant Astronaut and Marooned and even Stowaway to the Moon. Does anybody remember that one? Little kid gets in the boat from his grandpa and goes up the waterways to Launch Complex 39 and stows away in the Apollo capsule. When it came to books, there was Spaceport USA by Marty Caden. Carrying the Fire by Mike Collins. And then I got this book from a friend at my church, and it was called The History of Rocketry and Space Travel. And it was written by two men, one whom I knew very well, Wernher von Braun, in terms of by reputation. And the other guy didn't know anything about him, didn't even recognize him. But it was a guy by the name of Frederick Ordway III. And all of these years later, it turns out now that I have probably read so many books by Mr. Ordway, and come to realize that he is probably one of the great chroniclers of our space program, very much a fellow space cadet, even at age 82, as he is now. Frederick Ordway III joins us by phone from the Washington, D.C. area, and welcome to Space Talk, sir. It's glad to have you with us.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Good. Well, Frederick, we briefly chatted the other day, of course, to prepare for the program. And we realized we've probably been in the same room here at the Cape a lot of times, and we've never actually shook hands. And I just want to tell you how special it is to have you with us today. Give us a sense of, first of all, kind of who you are, your background, and how did your life become so intertwined with the likes of Wernher von Braun and the original rocket team?
Well, I'll tell you, my interest in rocketry was stemmed as many other things, and with other people, from an interest in space travel and science fiction magazines. I came across an early issue of Amazing Stories when I was just a kid, read it, began to buy books, mostly by Roy Rockwood and others, you know, Lost on the Moon and By Spaceship to Venus.
Oh, yeah.
I joined the American Rock Society when I was just 13, and I've been a member of it since. When I became an adult, I secured employment at the Reaction Motors Incorporated and the Rocket Engine Plant in northern New Jersey. Then the Guided Missile Division of Republic Aviation. And in 1952, I met Wernher von Braun at a meeting, a space flight and symposium at the American Museum of Natural History, Hayden Planetarium in New York.
Sure.
A couple of years later, he hired me to join him in Huntsville, Alabama, at the Army Ballistic Missile Agency, and I worked there until our whole team was transferred into the brand new George C. Marshall Space Flight Center at Marshall, and so that's how I got started.
Now, you know, through all of that, of course, you got to know him and the team, and really, you know, I mentioned the one book I have, but your book, The Rocket Team, which is just probably your best or favorite one anyway.
Well,
I think it really tells the story.
Yeah, I mean, I've done something like 35 books of either author, co-author, or editor. But The Rocket Team was, we spent an awful lot of time doing it with my co-author, Mitch Sharp, who's no longer with her, with us. I've traveled, taking advantage of all the trips I could. I went all the way to New Zealand to interview one person. I was in Russia and Poland and Germany and England and so forth. So there was a great deal of work went into that, and the original contract was with William Heinemann in London, and the book came out in 1979 there. We had a near-simultaneous U.S. hardcover edition. Both of these are hardcover, incidentally, with Thomas White Kroll, And that got full credit. The entire first page of the New York Times book review section, which is delightful, plus I think four columns inside.
Right.
So we got a nice boost. The editor at the time said, "This is the kind of thing we pray for." And then we went into a paperback edition with the MIT Press in 1982. Another paperback edition in 91. And then the current Apogee book hardcover came out in 2003, and now we in the paperback edition.
Yeah, and the paperback edition Apogee Books, by the way, and we've talked about Apogee Books before, and our friend Rick Connor up there has a great CD DVD in the back of it with a whole bunch of great interviews and video and still pictures of all the work.
It's got some early talks by Wernher von Braun. It's got pictures of the V2 firings. It's loaded with stuff.
Well, and writing this book, what was your sense of this team in terms of what they wanted to do and how hard was it? I mean, they were solving some of the most fundamental problems of rocketry that eventually got us to the moon.
Well, yeah, that's true, and I was fascinated in the history, while working in the field and being a member of many societies and attending meetings all over the world, I became more and more interested in the background of that team. I mean, we worked with members of the team at the Army Ballistic Missile Agency and later at the Marshall Center, but I wanted to know how that team came together. And it's quite interesting because you go back to the 1920s in Germany, there was one of the great pioneers was a man named Hermann Oberth, who was von Braun's mentor, who wrote his famous book on rocket into interplanetary space, space, which was published back in 1923. And then a few years later, they had this Society for Space Travel, which founded in Breslau. And that soon grew to nearly 1,000 members and drew in all kinds of people in Germany, and this is not the best time. I mean, Germany lost World War I, and things were really tight, but these organizations prospered, and not only this first one, but they had other ones that set up between say 27 up into about 37, several of them in different parts of Germany. I guess the most famous other than that one was the Society for Space Research, founded by a guy named Albert Pullenberg. And they did their rocket studies and flights and did all kinds of things. Well, then about this time, this work came to the attention of the Army. And specifically a Captain Walter Dornberger, who was also a professional engineer. And he was working in the Army Ordnance's ballistics section. And he got interested in these. His mentors were a man named Carl Becker and Carl Krantz, who's authors of a standard textbook on ballistics. That had a section on the ballistics of rockets. And at the time, the Germans were prohibited from developing long-range artillery and fighter aircraft because of the Versailles Treaty. But they, just in case, they said, well, hell, why don't we look at this rocket? This may be a way that's not prohibited by any treaty, and we can do some research on this, which might be valuable to us in the future.
I'm sure anyone
specifically thinking of, you know, of World War II, just as military guys.
Yeah, I'm not sure anyone in World War I even knew what a rocket was.
Yeah, well, there were rockets. The French fired little air-to-air rockets called the Prier in World War I. And there were signal rockets and lit up trenches at night. So there were something, you know, going on, both in Germany and France. But, no, this was strictly something brand new. We here in the United States had our rocket pioneers, and so did the Russians.
Right.
But it really found fallow ground in Germany. And as became World War II got closer, and they didn't know there was going to be a World War II, but Germany was nervous about its military, just in case. And so the German military began to snoop around, and they watched some of these amateur rockets fire. They had the rocketeers had a little rocket and fluke plots, a rocket launching field in a Berlin suburb. And they were quite impressed, particularly Dornberger. And so they also, Dornberg also was impressed by one of the young members just out of high school. And back in October 1932, they hired him, Werner von Braun. And von Braun continued to work, part-time work and part-time going out for his doctorate in physics. The Army paid for it. Even though he came from a wealthy family, he had that support.
Yeah.
So beginning in 1932, the Army was in, you know, and only 2 years later, you know, Hitler came to power.
Yeah.
And so all that time, all the amateur rockets were closed up. It became a military and a secret operation. And the Army hired a lot of these rocketeers. But the main one they got, of course, was Werner von Braun.
Yeah, Mr. Edward, we're going to hold that thought right there. And when we're going to pause here for our five-minute built-in hold here at the bottom of the hour. When we pick up that story and talk about how the difference between what the rocket team kind of wanted to do in terms of space exploration and, of course, what Germany was all about in terms of the war and how that has dealt with the history has dealt with that through the years. So stand by. We'll be back with Mr. Ordway in just a few moments. Space Talk brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust. Performance you can count on. Again, I'm Jim Behnke, and you're listening to WMMB.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
And welcome back to the second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by United Space Alliance. 321-768-1240, the phone number to call, *1240, for local AT&T wireless customers along the Space Coast. spacetalking@aol.com by email gets you here too, and we certainly have time to take your questions if you want to give us a shout. You can follow us through the week on Twitter at Space Talking, and I remind everyone that Space Talk can be heard live online right now at wmmbam.com, and each week a recording of today's show will be available as a podcast to download, again at wmmbam.com. The only website address you need to know. Our friend Tracy Yates from United Space Alliance had some business today to attend to. She promises to join us again next week. But suffice it to say that work to prepare Space Shuttle Endeavour for launch at 4:39 a.m. Eastern Time on Super Bowl Sunday is going well. The flight crew was here this week for the practice countdown and some other training. And so once again, the next launch from the Cape appears to be on schedule for Sunday, February 7th. Let's go back to our guest line and continue our conversation with noted author and I hope my newest friend, Frederick Ordway III. Mr. Ordway?
Well, I certainly hope so, and I'm looking forward to see you in June.
It should be fun at the induction for the Hall of Fame here, our Astronaut Hall of Fame. We're talking about Werner von Braun, the rocket team, and, you know, this team formed. It was a rocket club. I know they wanted to do some, I mean, they had dreams of Moon and Mars, and then Germany goes to war. And you know, and now there's all this talk, and we talked a little bit about it before, you know, Werner von Braun, Nazi Germany. I mean, how, you know, history is swinging back and forth depending on who you talk to. Tell us, what was the real scoop? What were these guys all about?
Well, we'll go back just very quickly to the after the Army closed down all these little private rocket testing guys. They hired a bunch of them, including von Braun at an Army research station at Kummersdorf, which is another suburb of Berlin. And that took place back in 1932. They worked there 1933, 1934. Then as the path seemed to be going perhaps to a war, the Hitlerian government was in and so forth, they wanted to you know, advance the technology of rocketry, but and far away from certainly a major city. So they re-established this rocket team that had formed at Kummersdorf, and they moved that up to what we all know as Peenemünde. It was up in the Baltic Sea on the island of the Usedom.
Mm-hmm.
And they started building a major facility. They had Luftwaffe support. And Army support to get things going. Ended up with the Luftwaffe took the western part of it, and the Army operated from the eastern part. And by the late 37 and on to, they were beginning to fire rockets. Actually, they fired them somewhat earlier from there, the A-2s and A-3s and earlier rockets. But this thing built up to a major Ballistic Missile Research Center during World War II. And they've test-fired and their V-2 rockets, what became known as the V-2. They called it the A-4.
Mm-hmm.
And they were later weaponized towards the end of the war and entered into service against targets in the United Kingdom, targeted mainly London and Norwich. And they also targeted parts of continental Europe that had been reoccupied by the Allies, particularly the port of Antwerp.
Mm-hmm.
So that V-2 became a weapon of war, the first ballistic missile. A whole new era of warfare was being initiated. They also had what they call the V-1, but the Germans call the Fi-103, which is they call it a flying bomb. It was a pilotless missile, and they were also introduced. That was not a Von Braun project, but the two V weapons came in together, and about 25,000 missiles, mainly V-1s, were flown during World War II, right up almost to the end of hostilities. And that's a whole story in itself. Then you got the dispersion of the German team. The Russians were moving in the spring of 1945 into the northern Germany, Peenemünde area. It's another long story, which is covered in the rocket team.
Right, very well done.
That team dispersed to southern Bavaria, they were anxious to get captured by the Americans, and their joke had always been that they decided they didn't want to be captured by the Russians. They feared them. They didn't want to be captured by the French because they never liked the French.
Mm-hmm.
The British couldn't afford them, so that left the Americans. And anyway, they made a conscious effort, and they were captured. The von Braun and members of his teams had an early contact with the with American troops, and just down at the southern part of Germany, practically on the border of Austria.
Yeah, and the next thing you know, they're in New Mexico, and then the next thing you know, they're in Huntsville.
That's right. So they were then they were interrogated in a place called Reutte in southern Germany, and then contracts American technical and scientific experts were swarming into occupied Germany because they wanted the technology. The Nazis Navy wanted Nazi submarine secrets, and the Air Force wanted Messerschmitt's latest stuff, and I mean so on and so forth. And they also knew about the Von Braun team, and Von Braun was a target. He was captured, and negotiations were carried out with a man named Holger Tolstoy, with the top American involved in dealing with that particular rocket team.
Right.
And they signed contracts, which were supposed to be originally just a year in duration, to bring over 125. Von Braun wanted 500, but that was just too much. And so they brought them over to Fort Bliss, Texas. And they also captured a lot of unflown V-2 rockets. There were many, many rockets that were still in the manufacturing process or had been completed in storage or in field storage. And they brought about to reassemble about 100 V-2 rockets over to the States. Those rockets were eventually assembled and flown at White Sands, New Mexico. So the team basically were housed at Fort Bliss, about 90 miles to the south, and the rockets were refurbished and fired for upper atmosphere research purposes.
And von Braun had the science, he had the exploration in his head all the time.
Oh, yeah, all the time. We know that back from his earliest things. In fact, he was jailed for about 3 weeks up in Stettin, Germany, during the war, but he was accused of two things. One, not really being interested in developing the V-2 to save the fatherland and win World War II.
Yeah.
But moreover, that he had kept a plane in which he had planned to fly to England with V-2 secrets.
Right.
Well, of course, he could never prove the latter, but he did have a plane because he commuted, and he was a pilot. He commuted all over Germany in his little plane to meet with contractors and university people and research institutes and so forth. Anyway, with Dornberger, his boss, eventually, and the help of Reich Minister Speer, the munitions minister, he was released.
And Mr. Ordway, we've just got a couple of minutes left with you, and what I want to do is I want to jump forward real quick, because I'm really interested to learn from you when what was Von Braun like in terms of his reaction when the final go to go to the moon, whether it was Kennedy's speech in May of 61, he's already developing the hardware, but when he had the clear idea that, you know, we were going to do this, I mean, was he like a kid in a candy store?
I mean, well, he was. I mean, he was the major person in the United States who promoted the lunar program. Going back to about 1952 to 54, in that period, he came out with a stunning series of articles by he and his colleagues, including my professor of astronomy at Harvard, Fred Whipple. And they wrote these a series of eight issues of Collier's Magazine.
All right.
And then from that was Collier's Magazine, three books published by Viking Press came out. They had a spaceflight symposia at the Hayden Planetarium. That's where I met Von Braun.
Right.
And then he was going all over the country talking about spaceflight, and he became, you know, almost a rock star. He was so well-known at the time.
Well, and a lot of folks of my generation remember the Disney films that he did.
And the three Disney films that he made with Walt Disney. I mean, he was out there at every angle publicizing this, and space stations and launch vehicles and lunar reconnaissance vehicles and, of course, the ultimate onto Mars. And so that was a dream that he had started in Germany, became realized in the United States, and which is interesting. Here's a former German working for the Nazi government who became the head of the Army's ballistic missile program, then was transferred to NASA and became the director of NASA, what was then NASA's largest field station, the George C. Marshall Space Flight Center.
Right.
And I remember asking Keith Glennon, the first NASA administrator, when you discussed Von Braun with General Eisenhower, was there any problems? Did he think this was peculiar that a former enemy, an enemy only, you know, less than a decade earlier,
right,
is now running this big NASA George C. Marshall Space Flight Center? And Keith Glennon said, you know, he said, Fred, the subject never came up.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It is amazing.
So now let me get one more question in with you. We've got about less than a minute to go.
Yeah,
the
sure.
First Saturn V lifts off in 1967, and after it happens, the first time you see him, what was his reaction? Did you talk about it? Was he jumping up and down?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was ecstatic, you know. I mean, and the Saturn program is interesting in and of itself, that there was never a failure. In the history of rocketry, there was no failure. There were anomalies. We had a vibration problem called Pogo, and there were anomalies. But every Saturn rocket from the Saturn 1 series, there were over 30 of them, and the Saturn 1B, and then the huge Saturn 5, every one of those rockets, not a single failure.
And then that's a great
Nothing
way to...
Nothing like that in the history of rockets.
No, we're going to wrap it right up there. Mr. Ordway, thank you for being with us. I hope we can get back to you again in June for the Hall of Fame. And thanks for spending time with us.
I will definitely be down there, so let's get together.
That's right. Thank you so much, sir. When we return real quick, are you ready for some football? Well, we're going to have some gratuitous talk about the Vikings in a moment. But I've got an honest reason for bringing it up. You wondering what it is? Stay tuned. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
Well, welcome back to Space Talk as we begin our final segment of today's program, brought to you, as always, by United Space Alliance. Oh, there you go. As many of you know, I'm a big football fan who bleeds purple for my Minnesota Vikings. Big game tomorrow night, and let me tell you, despite all my travels throughout my career, it was only last fall that I finally made it to the NFL's Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. And let me spend a moment and tell you, if you're a football fan at any level, you really need to go. You really need to see it once, twice, a couple of not only is the hall itself an outstanding showcase of NFL history, the people there and around Canton are incredibly helpful, incredibly nice. And if you go to the Hall of Fame, I'm telling you, aim for a Thursday morning, because that's when there's a volunteer in there named Betty. She's on duty. She says Thursday mornings, if I recall right, she's 92 years old, probably knows more about football than anybody else. You know, even John Madden, she says, comes to her for stories. And I guess the best way to explain her is to say that when I was at the Hall of Fame, my son Jason was with me, And she offered to take our picture next to the statue of Jim Thorpe. Instead, you know, we wanted to take a picture of her because she was so charming. And Jason took a picture of her and posted it on his Facebook page with the caption that says, "This is Betty. She is more awesome than you could ever hope to be." Okay, so now what does this have to do with the space program? Well, I'll tell you what. I got an honest reason to bring it up this time. This Wednesday, the crew of Space Shuttle Atlantis during the STS-129 mission that flew last November is going to be at the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton to make a very special presentation. And to tell us more about that, on the phone from Canton is the Vice President of Communications and Exhibits for the Hall of Fame, Joe Horrigan. Joe, welcome to Space Talk.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Glad to talk to you finally on the phone, sir. Well, let's get right to it. What's happening on Wednesday? Who do you got coming, and what do they got for you?
Yeah, well, as you said, we have the crew from the I'm going to blow it here, STS-129, is that correct?
That's right.
That's correct. They obviously are coming here for a specific purpose, but there's really an interesting story behind it. One of the pilots, Leland Melvin,
right,
actually was drafted by the Detroit Lions in the 11th round in 1989. And Leland obviously is a big football fan. He had an injury in training camp with the Lions and didn't make the squad, and then later had a tryout again with the Dallas Cowboys and didn't make that squad.
Tried to show off in front of Roger Staubach and something happened.
Well, but he went on to a higher calling, I would think, and I mean that with a pun intended.
Right.
You know, now being an astronaut. And, you know, what he did, though, is we had been contacted through NASA to find out if possibly we'd like to send something up in the most recent mission to the space shuttle, Leland being a football fan.
Right.
So, of course, we said absolutely yes. And when we were discussing what it might be, they decided that I was too big to stick into a compartment, so they
right.
left me behind. But they did decide that the fitting in two ways, size-wise and apropos, was the football with the names of every Hall of Famer on it, so that we could say we put every Hall of Famer in space. So
yeah, that's great.
And then we had the idea, as we were thinking of small objects, what about the coin that would be used at the coin toss for the Super Bowl?
Right.
Of course, everybody's very excited about that, so I called the league office to make sure that would be fine by them, and of course they were excited as well. So both items went up with Leland and the crew, and they're coming not only to present us with those two items, but Leland's previous flight, having had tryouts with both the Lions and the Cowboys, he took a jersey from each team with him on a previous flight. So they're bringing those with them as well. So we're really excited. We're going to take the jerseys and ball and put them on display right away, and we're going to have our president and executive director, Steve Perry, and deliver the coin to the Super Bowl, to the NFL at the Super Bowl in South Florida.
All right. And this will be on display at the Hall of Fame. Is this a temporary exhibit, a permanent exhibit, or?
Well, everything we basically say, everything at the Hall of Fame is temporary because we never know what's going to happen, but certainly it's going to have a long stay with us. And, you know, we feel that this is really a unique, something different, you know. And we like, as you say, you know, we like to present our museum in a fashion that has something for everyone, and if you've been there once, you come back, there's something new and different. So, yeah, we like to rotate our exhibits, but when something this significant comes our way, it's this different, we really like to keep it there for quite a while.
I'm chuckling. Our board operator, Aaron, tells me, he says, finally a record the Lions can be proud of, that the Lions actually have something fun at the Hall of Fame. That's a good one. Joe, I didn't even realize until really this week, maybe I'm the only one, the last one to realize it, but if the next shuttle launch does launch on time, it'll be at 4:39 in the morning on Super Bowl Sunday. It'll be a night launch, possibly the last night launch of the program. If you are all down in Miami, there is no, if it's clear, you'll see it. And what kick off the Super Bowl Sunday celebration.
Oh, no kidding. And that would be a real temptation because, as you know, I had the pleasure of witnessing the last flight and or the last launch, and it is remarkable. Obviously, it was a day launch, but I'll tell you what, I've never seen anything quite like it. It was so impressive, and I really wish people, I know we see it on television and the news and so on, but you just can't appreciate it, and it makes you think about what really has gone into the enormous amount of work and research. And I think of my grandfather, who lived to be 92, and I once asked him, I said, "Hey, Pop," I said, "you know, you've seen a lot of things in your life. What's the most impressive thing you've seen?" And he was a big fan of the space program, and
right.
I was betting that he was going to say man walking on the moon. This is the late 80s that I asked him this. And he thought for a moment. He says, no, the most impressive thing I saw was when man flew.
Mm.
I thought, oh, my goodness. He saw both, you know, the first men flying in the early stages and men landing on the moon. And what a tremendous, you know, journey we've seen, as all Americans have seen, you know, in recent history. The pioneers that have gone into space, it's just a remarkable story.
Yeah, that's so gratifying to hear. And, of course, you know, I'm, as a big football fan, I've done a lot of studying on this. And, you know, the space program itself has contributed so much to the success of the NFL in a lot of indirect ways. I'm not even sure people are aware of it. But the key one, the one that's most visible, is the fact that, you know, during the season, I'm watching my Minnesota Vikings here in Florida, courtesy of a dish on my roof that's receiving a signal directly from a satellite in space.
Question about it. And miniaturized, I mean, everything, you know, when we talk about the computer and the development of the microchip and all that, let's face it, there was a whole lot of influence from the space program that went into that.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, with just a few seconds left, Joe, any picks? Vikings against who?
You know, I got to honestly tell you, this is maybe the first time in my recent history that that I can honestly tell you that I have no problem with any one of these four teams winning a Super Bowl. These teams have just great stories in and of themselves. And, of course, we're all partial to the Brett Favre comeback story. But, you know, when you think about Peyton Manning, we're probably watching the greatest quarterback ever.
Yeah. Well, I had a lot.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I had a lot of fun with Betty when we were up there. And, you know, it was the week after the season opening when the Vikings had just beat Cleveland. And she and I had a lot of good trash talking going back and forth. But anyway, hey, Joe, thanks. We're going to run out of time here. But thanks for being on the show today, and have fun on the ceremony Wednesday. And if you ever get back down here, we'll give you a tour of our Hall of Fame.
Terrific. I appreciate it very much.
Take care, sir. Thanks for being with us. Well, we're going to wrap it up here. Next week on Space Talk, my guests are going to be Joe DeLay from NASA and Dave Cormick from Boeing. They are the folks at the Kennedy Space Center in charge of getting the Tranquility node ready for launch on Endeavor in a couple of weeks on Super Bowl Sunday, which hopefully will be the Vikings against the Jets. Well, we'll talk about that mission and related space station topics next week, so please tune in. We'll see you next week.